How you doing there? Just a quickie before we start. On the Apple podcast, why don't you double click on David McWilliams Plus? It's right there when you open the podcast. You get ad-free, you unlock early access. Just double click and away you go. David McWilliams Plus. You get this pure and simple.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How you doing there? It is podcast time. We're going to keep on the theme that we were discussing on Tuesday, which is my recent trip to Ukraine. And later on, in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to an old mate of mine who came with me, Sasha Kabanovsky, to kind of give the view of somebody born and bred in the Soviet Union, somebody who lived, born in Kyiv, whose parents were from that neck of the woods, who has the local view of where that part of the world goes. How are you, John? Now that I'm back, I'm resplendent now. I was a bit traumatized
I'm delighted you're back. You know, that could have gone any sort of way, but it's great you're back. And it was a fascinating trip. And I'm still kind of chuckling away at some of the clips you were showing me from
the Comedy Club.
The Comedy Club. Fantastic. But I was really surprised at that, you know? And as we spoke about on Tuesday, how life continues
on. Life goes on.
Evolves and all that kind of stuff.
I'll tell you what was interesting. So the way getting out of Ukraine is as tricky as getting in, right? It didn't sound that tricky. You get a plane to Poland, you get a bus, and all that. But it's tricky and it's a pain. Getting out is much more complicated. And so I got a lift from Kiev to a place called Lutsk, which is close to Belarus. And then I waited for a bus, right? And you're in the middle of nowhere. And the bus may or may not come. And
you're the 46A.
It's the 46A, yeah, exactly. They come in threes. They come at the same time, right? But the problem is you're kind of thrown out of the car with your rucksack. And you're like, see you later. And then you're on a street in Ukraine on your own, right?
Right.
And you're thinking, I said, is this a bus? Oh, yeah, the bus is there, coming. And
Tuesday.
Yeah, and then you're waiting for the bus. And the first few moments, you're like, you're fine, yeah, la, la, la. And of course, on the border, there's no internet coverage at all.
Right.
Actually, one good thing that Elon Musk has done is the Starlink project in Ukraine.
Yes.
Because they managed to keep, because of Elon Musk, when there is coverage, it is better than anything you'll ever get in Ireland.
No, really?
I swear to God, it's like, you know, if you've got 4 bars, you've got 10 bars on your phone, right?
Jesus, yeah. Elon, why don't you put one of those satellites, sit it over Ireland?
Over Dunleary.
Yeah.
Just over Dunleary. Now, the interesting, so Elon Musk, on the one hand, the Ukrainians were saying is advocating that they make peace and they do a deal with Putin and they don't like him for that. But actually, the practicalities of Starlink have meant, and you forget that communication is unbelievably important when you are under attack or when you feel threatened, that you can actually text your mates, you can actually go online, whatever. So where there is coverage, the coverage is amazing, but where you're close to borders, the military block all coverage.
Right.
Because obviously coverage gives geolocation and geolocation gets you killed.
As we learned from the Bellingcat boys.
Yeah, and it gets you killed.
Yeah.
So all around huge areas of Ukraine, there's no coverage at all. So you're deposited there, you're thinking, okay, this is grand. I know Poland is generally that direction, maybe 100 miles or right. 200 miles. And I'm in the middle of nowhere. And then eventually you just hear the bus trundling up. And everything's dark because it's a blackout. It's a curfew. So everything is dark, right? And you just see this bus trundling up. And the bus was coming amazingly. Think about this. From southern Ukraine, from Odessa, all the way to Warsaw, right?
Wow.
So it's been on the...
It's a bit of a trip.
Yeah. So I get on the bus and the bus driver's looking at me and he's like, where are you from, Ireland? And he's like, saying, what are you doing here, man? In the middle of nowhere on your own?
Yeah.
And so you get in the bus, but to come back to your point about humor, everyone says hello.
Yeah.
On the bus, right? Everyone's chatting, kind of goes around. There's a foreigner on the bus, an Irish bloke.
He's got red hair.
He's got red hair, exactly. And they're all chatting. And suddenly we're all chatting. So it's a humor. It's just, it's humans. It's humanity under conditions of adversity.
Yes.
It's all about talking, chatting. What are you doing here? La, la, la. Where are you going? I said, I'm going to Lublin, which is just over the border. They said, we're going to Warsaw. I said, where are you going after that? We're not too sure. Maybe Berlin. Like it was a very...
Were these guys getting out
these
of...
These were women. No guys.
Okay, but getting out
of Ukraine.
Right. With all their belongings.
With all their belongings, you know, and they've got those little, you know, those bags that you see in Central and Eastern Europe all the time. They're kind of multicolored, big, quite heavy bags. You can carry loads of them. And then...
Laundry bags, kind of.
Big laundry bags, full of everything. And then what you realize is, and again, I think I mentioned on Tuesday, the idea of being displaced. We waited, so the bus takes off and we're all having a chat and people can speak English, other people can't. Other than my really bad, rusty combination of Russian and Croatian comes together. But it's a Slavic language, so people are quite impressed, you know, a couple of words and they're like, oh my God. Anyway, then you arrive at the Polish border. And we waited for 5 hours. 5 hours. In the middle of the night. So at
for what though?
From 1 till 6 a.m. And that really pissed me off. Because it was the Polish side, it was the EU side that just decided that they might not necessarily expedite people going through. So we wait in the bus. Then somebody will come on, we'll take
it. Is it just waiting for the morning shift, as it were?
Yeah, and it was a real pain in the ass. And I felt like saying,
do you not know who I am?
Exactly. You know, my podcast. But it's the sort of the ritual humiliation of the second-class citizen. So the Poles know that they, as members of the European Union, are first-class citizens.
Mm.
The Ukrainians, as refugees, are second-class citizens. And it's the way in which... the time of the second-class citizen is regarded as inconsequential.
Yeah.
So we'll make an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. Like you could see Poland. It was 100 yards away.
Yeah.
And it was just these three lads decided, you know, we'll go for a cup of tea. We'll go for a coffee. We'll pull down the shutters for a while. And I kind of thought to myself, we as Europeans, members of the European Union, you know, we should be much more cognizant of the fact that the vast majority of people in that bus who were really lovely to me, are traumatized. They have been traumatized from a war zone.
Of course, yeah.
But then we go into Poland. By the way, if you've got a Polish audience, I've never been so delighted to be in Poland in my life. Got over the border, said, thanks for the Jesus. Yeah. Thanks for the Jesus. And
one bit you skipped over there is you got a train in. Why didn't you get the train out?
Ah, because very few trains out. So the train lines are sporadic, right?
Okay.
But also they're booked up. Completely
booked. Really?
Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, so do you know who I am? You can't go in. It's not like getting the dart and say, do you know who I am? Like, no, I tried to get the train. They said, sorry, mate, there's no seats. So then you've got to go on the hitching a lift, getting a bus, the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. Okay, to bring it back, you know, on Tuesday, we had a brilliant discussion and you described your trip, which was fantastic. And gave
I'll take
us
a, you the next time.
Well, I'd love to go. I really would love to go.
Imagine the two Egypts on the bus.
But there was, it gave great kind of sense of life in a war-torn city.
Yeah.
And it's fantastic. And that was the Ukrainian view. But as we also said, there is the opposing view.
Or somebody from Ukraine. So what we're going to talk about, John, we're going to talk to Sasha Kabanovsky, who came with me. And, well, actually, I actually went with him. In
right,
Venice,
okay,
right?
Yeah.
And just to give you a little bit of background, I told on Tuesday, but, you know, life is bizarre over the years. Somebody once said to me, and a mate of mine, an Israeli mate of mine, Pinkas. Remember Pinkas?
Oh, yes. Landa. Yeah.
And he said to me,
in his very deep voice.
He's a very deep voice. Yeah. He's like Eeyore from the thing. Yes. Like, it's all going to end horribly. And he's a little bit pessimistic about the world. But his wife, Judith, one day said to me, she said, you know, some people in the world collect stamps and David McWilliams collects friends. Right?
Fair enough.
And we were just laughing one night. So Sasha, just to give people a sense, on Tuesday, I said this, but I'll reiterate again. So years and years ago, I had a mad idea to go to Russia to learn Russian. Mad idea, 1991, middle of the end of the Cold War, struck me as an incredibly intelligent idea to do. So I arrived in this small school in a town called Novi Ruza in the middle of nowhere, which is on the, people who know that part of the world, it's on the road from Smolensk to Moscow.
Right.
Right. And the next stop is Belarus. So you're in basically Western Russia.
Okay.
And I had a teacher who, God bless her, Tanya was trying to explain to this Irish bloke about Russia and Russian language. And then I got a bit bored after about 2 months of being a little...
bored?
Yeah, I got bored of Russia. And, you know, we kind of got quite conversant in Russian. But anyway, I've forgotten most of it. But I wanted to go to Leningrad.
Mm.
Because that was the big city. Now, Moscow, I'd been to because there was a train to Moscow. But I wanted to go to Leningrad. Leningrad, for some reason, was more evocative, more historical, more interesting, all that sort of stuff. And she said, yeah, you can go to Leningrad. And you can actually stay with my cousin. And that's what gave me a real sense of how Russians lived. I stayed in an apartment, tiny apartment, maybe the size of...
Well, no, it was kind of real Soviet.
Yeah,
block,
that, kind of, oh, yeah, but block. The 30th floor.
Jesus.
And there were three generations of family. There was... the cousin who was married with kids and the granny. So there's a granny, mum and dad, and the kids all in two rooms.
God almighty.
And me.
Yeah.
Bing bong, how are you? It's me from Dublin, right?
I'm looking for an ensuite.
Exactly. I can't quite believe, as you said, there's no spa opportunity here. But anyway, my teacher said, you can't go to Leningrad on your own. You're too obviously Western, yeah. Right? And you can't speak the language. You think you can, but you can't. Yeah. And it's an overnight train. It's about 20 hours and you're going to get robbed or worse, right?
Yeah.
So you need a Russian to go with you. And she says, my daughter will go with you. So we traveled to Leningrad. Then I left Russia, la, 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 la. And over the years, keeping in intermittent contact. So Sasha, who came with me, is Nastya's best mate.
Right.
So
okay.
That's
okay.
How we know each other. Yeah. But it's weird how life goes. You meet people years ago, you stay friends with them, and you end up, suddenly you're on the Polish border, you know, on your own saying, how did I get here?
This is not my beautiful wife.
This is not my beautiful house. David Byrne, we were going to genuflect to you. So let's actually go and talk to Sasha, because he's from the region.
Yeah.
He's going to give us his view, their view, what's going on. So let's go and talk to Sasha, who's now in Berlin. Sasha, how are you doing?
Good, thanks, David. How are you?
I'm grand. It's slightly, I love the idea. I went over with my typical Irish optimism about the weather. And after about 5 minutes, Sasha says, I think you're slightly, we met at this border crossing in Poland. And he looks at me and says, I think you're slightly underdressed.
I would have said nothing had I not warned you four times to dress warmly because it was expected to be very cold where we were going.
This is you returning blue, Mac.
The indomitable Irish optimism.
Exactly. All the time. So, Sasha, just, give me your sense now. You're back in Berlin a couple of days. What's your sense of the week we spent, the trip? Particularly, you went to see your family. You met old friends. You got a feel for what I thought was quite interesting. When we went down to the metro, you said, my God, it's like being a kid again. This is exactly the same as it was when I was a kid. Same sounds, same smells, same metro.
Same trains.
So give me your sense. Give me your sense as a born and bred Ukrainian of what you just saw.
I'm still trying to process it because the last time I was in Kiev was in 2013 at the end of the year. And actually I walked around the Maidan when Ukrainians started protesting against the deal that Yanukovych wanted to cut with the Russians. And the feeling there was, it was amazing to see thousands of people standing out in the cold and actually demanding to be heard and standing up for their rights. And going back now, we saw the result of that, right? We saw what that led to, and this indomitable spirit of not giving in has brought war. And I don't know how to explain it. I don't think that I can relate it. I mean, how would you feel if you saw, when we drove into the city, the first thing that we saw were the anti-tank hedgehogs and pillboxes in the middle of a European, vibrant European city, a beautiful city, right?
Yeah.
And I still can't process it. I think it's too difficult to put that in context. What it's one thing to read about it. It's one thing to see it on TV. It's completely different when you see the sounds, the smells. I mean, when we went to Borodyanka and we still smelt the burnt out housing. I mean, how can you relate that 6 months, almost 12 months past?
Yeah, we went, just so you know, we went to Bucha and Borodyanka, which were the places in Irpin, the suburbs, which, and again, to put it in the context for listeners, these are like normal suburbs, about 20K outside the city. You see normal housing, you see people going around their business, and then you're presented with the extraordinary image of it's brutalism, it's vandalism, it's violence. And amazingly, as Sasha said, the place still smells charred, which is a kind of a very eerie feeling. But Sasha, I want to ask you about your aunt and your family that you kept going over to visit. I was deposited in the hotel, and Sasha kept going up the road to visit. How are they? Tell me about them. Tell me about their background. Give us a sense of your background as well. I mean, of who your people are, what they feel now about it, how they are coping with continuing to live there.
So to put it into context, I grew up, I think I had a very sort of typical upbringing and background for most of the people in the Soviet Union, at least in the European part of the Soviet Union. So my grandparents were war veterans. My grandfather went from Kiev to Berlin in the cavalry unit. So the losses in the cavalry unit during World War II were horrendous. And he brought the war back with him. For the rest of his life, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was in the underground in Kiev, and my paternal grandparents lost the entirety of their families at Babi Yar when the Nazis executed 33,000 Jews, and my grandmother escaped because a local polizei warned her that she shouldn't go to the gathering place with the Germans, and she evacuated from Kiev on horseback, and she lost her firstborn son to starvation along the way. So, we were all brought up with a great sense of pride and love for that achievement, and I think that everyone's sense of the Soviet Union and was based on that the defining moment of World War II. And no one really, I mean, okay, we understood that we were Ukraine. There was Russia, but there was a sense of unity where one could interpose Russia, Ukraine for the other without too much problem. But that's gone.
Alex, explain to me, growing up as a child of the Soviet Union, that sense that the Soviet Union was something to be proud of, something also permanent, and something that something that you could look back to the Second World War, you could look back to the achievements of defeating Nazism and say, that's enough, that's us.
Yeah, in essence, there was the World War II defined the Soviet Union, and World War II, I think, prolonged the agony of the Soviet or the communist state because it gave legitimacy. This was this was viewed as a titanic achievement. 27 million Russians died, or Russians, Soviets. Much of the fighting, and actually 20% of the officer corps were Ukrainians, and actually two of the best artillery schools in the Soviet Union were based in Kiev, and that's one of the reasons why the Ukrainians are doing such a bang-up job of using artillery against the Russians, because there is a really strong military tradition of excellence stemming from World War II and before that in Ukraine. And this is one of the reasons why the Russians are having such a difficult time currently. But just to finish up very quickly, World War II, there's nothing beyond World War II. And all of the rhetoric and all of the crap that the Putin regime has been building their policies around, their legend around, always goes back to World War II. And they've completely crapped all over that achievement that, that all of the people went through in 45 and completely denigrated it at this time.
Now, it's funny, when we were traveling on the train from Poland, you said to me, as somebody born in the Soviet Union, it feels like you're kind of divorcing Russia. You're kind of falling out of love. Explain that to me.
Well, you grow up with this legend. You're a child, right? And it's very easy to manipulate children into these legends and Santa Claus and whatever else, except for the Santa Claus in the Soviet Union was Lenin and the bright tomorrow. And as you grow up, this is the problem with the Soviet system. They gave you a relatively good education and they taught you to think to some extent. But if you were an honest and decent human being, you could not close. The more you learned, the more apparent it became that there was no glory to the system, no glory to the past. And in fact, the past was a huge lie. And one could, if you are intellectually honest, nothing but shame, regret, and sadness would define Russian history, Soviet history. And wherever you dig, wherever you look, the fig leaf, as soon as you remove it, there's nothing there except for pain. And so in essence, yes, it is. And the Ukraine is going through a very painful divorce, paying for it with tens of thousands of lives. But they will never go back to Russia or the supranational state because, well, it will not exist in the near future. But what it offers is darkness. There is a good and an evil. And in this conflict, in this situation, the evil is clearly defined.
And tell me about like your Russian friends. What are they seeing? Because I mean, now you've said that when you were a kid, when you were younger, when you were growing up, there was no real distinction. Ukrainian Russian was interchangeable. Families were interlinked. Marriages between Ukrainians and Russians were totally par for the course. Now, what do your Russian friends feel, think? What sort of, are they foreboding? Are they optimistic? Are they in any way realistic? What's your sense?
Most of my Russian friends are no longer in Russia. Only a few are left. And they've basically, they have reasons for staying that one can respect, I guess. And they are in a situation akin to the Stalinist era of the 1930s. They say nothing. They hold no political discussions at home. The children are under strict instruction not to speak publicly of the views that that they hold. And there is a clear realization that this is the end. There is no hope for tomorrow. There is no sense of a brighter future for Russia. They're looking or they're awaiting this situation to take its course, and it's going to lead them where it will lead them. But there isn't a rainbow at the end of this story.
What amazed me in Ukraine, well, it doesn't amaze me, but it's something, you know, when a nation is under attack, something bizarre happens to the character, the spirit, the courage. I don't know what you call it, but what's interesting for me is that the Ukrainians' sentiment wasn't rage. It was kind of resilience. It was almost like cheekiness. It was almost like sticking your two fingers up and saying, okay, come and have a go if you think you're hard enough. And we know you're hard. And we are deep down. We are scared, but we're not going to be bamboozled. We're not going to be terrorized. How do you think this ends, number one? And number two, what do you think happens to that part of the world, to the Russian Empire? Because what was very interesting for me was the way in which Ukrainians continue to talk. And we're talking about to Ukrainians, young and old, and various different backgrounds, they all refer to this idea of the end of the Russian Empire, that this is an empire imploding, and that Ukraine is part of that process of empire diminishing, the end of the empire. Where does it go? Where do you think?
Well, I think that, as I said in the initial podcast with you, I think that this falls apart. How it falls apart, whether it's a huge mess or whether it's controlled, but there's no underpinning ideology. There is no underpinning society, no economy. There is nothing to hold this country together. A country, once again, that does not value its people, a country that has easily said goodbye to 10 million highly educated young people who chose to go west. How can we talk about a future? Because and of course, okay, you know, the argument was economically strong because of its natural resources, and militarily strong because it's of its huge military. Both of those are proving to be false. What's the price of natural gas in Europe today, as opposed to expectations?
It's fallen.
And actually, quite interesting, in the Russian Telegram chats, well, Russian opposition Telegram chats, they have a lively discussion about a potential scenario where Putin is deported to China under Xi's protection. And that will be his guarantee of a retirement. And it will give him an off-ramp for basically keeping his life and a few billion. And it will give an opportunity for some sort of a negotiated peace. But as you and I learned when we were in Ukraine, any sort of discussion that allows Russia to keep territorial gains in Ukraine is not going to be entertained. Maybe not because maybe the politicians would have been ready to accept this or discuss this, but you heard the people. The people are now driving this process. And no one is going to be kowtowing to any demands by the Russian side.
Yeah, no, it was very, very clear that what the Ukrainians demand is a full withdrawal from all areas of Ukraine, what I would call Ukraine proper, and from Crimea, because Crimea is slightly different. Again, I'm not sure that the West will be able to deliver that. That's, you know, at the end of the day, there will be some sort of cease. There has to be some sort of ceasefire. But it's very, very clear, Sasha, that what you're saying is that, and what the Ukrainians were saying is that Russia has to be brought to its knees in order for the peace and the ceasefire to be permanent. That's what I got from the Ukrainian side. They said, if we do a deal now, a partial deal, a halfway house deal, it's only a matter of years before this war starts again.
No, there is no deal that can be done that allows Russia to lick its wounds and somehow rebuild. Because at the end of the day, they will keep coming back. There's a conviction that they will continue to come back, because there is no other ideology that's going to keep that society going.
Sasha, what I want to ask you is, how do we reconcile the Russia of Joseph Brodsky, of Pushkin, of Tolstoy, of the greats, of the extraordinary mathematical tradition, of the extraordinary scientific tradition, of the unbelievably brilliant literary and intellectual tradition of Russia, and the achievements of the Soviet Union in its entirety? And there are achievements. How do you put that Russia, the Russia of the greats, and how do you square that with this Russia? And what, for non-Russian speakers, from non-Russian audience, is there a way of understanding the two extraordinary extremes of Russia?
The two extraordinary. So we had a Tuchev quote last podcast.
Give us it again.
I'll give you a different Tuchev quote. Russian history before Peter the Great is one of more is a memorial service, and after Peter the Great is a criminal case. And I can send quote after quote about what the greats thought about Russia. And this is a great illusion, right? Because the greats were never appreciated in their time. They were always treated and oppressed almost as criminals and opponents of the state. From Tolstoy to Dostoevsky to Glinka, this is a history of brutality. The greats were the greats because they were oppressed and they saw the inadequacy of the country. And if you really read their works, they're not happy works. They're not talking about how wonderful life is in Russia. And there is no happy ending unless you consider, you know, salvation. Well, of course, salvation at the end is a nice thing to look forward to. But one would like to have a few nice days here on Earth. And that's not what Russian literature is about.
And just before we go, economically, right? We're looking at Ukraine. It's very clear to me that Ukraine is a country that has been riddled by corruption before the war. It had been a wholesale kleptocratic country before the war, not unlike Putin's Russia. In actual fact, very, very much a mirror image, except for the fact that it has this bizarre, and this is what I was trying to understand, it is a kleptocracy with a vibrant democracy. So any country that votes in a different president every time around since the start of elections in the early 90s is a vibrant democracy. Any country that actually votes in a guy who is a comedian is a vibrant democracy. It's a really good sign.
Comedians are always a good sign, David.
They're always a good sign. They're absolutely right. You know, yes. We went to the comedy club.
When you turn to the comedians, you're on the right path.
No, but it's an impressive sign of a vibrancy, of a forgiveness, of an ability to take a chance. It's a sign that obviously the oppressive big man doesn't have all the control at the ballot box. But on the other hand, Ukraine was a classic kleptocracy in terms of economics. How does that change as we look forward?
David, we talk to a lot of people. We talk to guys in the military. We talk to aspiring politicians. We talk to comedians. The one message that we heard across the board was we're not going back to the old ways. And it's not perfect. Ukraine was never perfect. But the soldiers who are fighting the war, the clear message from them is we're going to beat one disease and we're going to come back from the front and we're going to beat another. And corruption, everyone, every thinking human being in Ukraine understands that corruption is the devil that needs to be conquered. And whether or not they succeed is a question mark. It's a tall order. But when the entire country is talking about this, it gives you hope.
And finally, the message that we received loud and clear from Ukrainians was that the big, still imponderable, although I think it's less imponderable now, is the West's support. I think the West has changed dramatically. I think up until recently, there was a perception of just give the Ukrainians enough arms just to hang on and let's hope there was going to be a settlement of some sort and let sanctions do their thing and that ultimately the economic weapons will bring the Russians to the table. That is not going to happen. And it seems to me we've seen a massive shift, even in the last couple of days from the West, in terms of the West now saying, if we give the Ukrainians more aims, they could actually go and win. I'm not saying win on the ground completely, but actually change the military dynamic to such an extent that the ceasefire will be beneficial to Ukraine. Is your fear now that the West does atrophy, that Putin's long-term game is still stay the course, grind it out, and over time a change in the United States, maybe at the top, the Republicans coming in, you see Germany is still very, very nervous about giving its fulsome support to Ukraine, that it will atrophy and that the Ukrainians will be left abandoned, or at least isolated and weakened?
Well, It seems like that's the only option that the Putin regime has at this point in time, is playing for time. And they know that democracies are really bad at drawn out conflicts. And they know that people's attention spans are limited. And of course, if there is an economic downturn in Europe and in the US, the stomach to continue to support Ukrainian fight against Russia is going to be, well, not as strong as it is at this particular moment. The remedy to that is to arm Ukraine as quickly as possible to give it a chance to resolve the situation in the summer, because technologically Russia cannot compete with anything that the West has been providing Ukraine to this point. The messages out of the expectations or the forecasts out of all leading Western think tanks is for a drawn out, prolonged combat period of a year, may stretch out into 24. I have a personal view on this.
Give me it.
I tend to be more hopeful, and I think that there's going to be a resolution during the summer. And I think that once Russia starts to crumble, it's like 91. It crumbled. The whole thing fell in a day. Cole was meeting with Walesa, and Cole was laughing at Walesa when Walesa was telling him that it's a matter of months before the wall comes down. Cole was telling him that he's dreaming. The next day, the wall came down and Cole said that he was at the wrong party and went back to Germany. In this part of the world, the Colossus is on very shaky ground and it can collapse underneath him very, very quickly. And in this part of the world, things tend to happen very quickly. So that's my view. But once again, I'm an optimist. Hopeful.
Well, listen, Sasha, we will talk again, and maybe we'll just get those rucksacks and go back to Kyiv at a certain stage in the spring, if you fancy it.
You know that I do. Great. Anytime, any place. you've got a friend in me.
Well, I just say the last time I just saw you, the pair of us were at the border in the Poland-Ukraine border for 5 hours. Was it 5 hours last weekend?
About that.
And I was doing my typical Irish optimist turn to sort of indignation. And I was about to march up to the Ukrainian soldier and say, "Let us in." And Sasha just
said, "Do you know who I am?"
Sasha just said,
that he actually said that. "Do you know who I am?"
No, I didn't. I said it to you, taking the piss. I didn't say it to the guy. But tell me, what was that expression in Russian that you had when you were leaving the Soviet Union?
"Don't say hope until you leave Chop."
So explain that to me again.
Chop was the border town between Ukraine and Czechoslovakia that that all emigres had to go through. And so until you actually went through this town of Chop and were out of the Soviet Union, one would never dare to speak the way that you spoke.
And it was quite funny because...
Overly optimistic.
Well, it's just funny. It's also a legacy of your past, your youth, your life, that you still had that fear that you had as a boy of soldiers, border guards, the authorities, that something awful could happen just at that last moment, just before we got out. And of course, I had the Irish...
That last moment is always the most dangerous, David. That's always the most dangerous. Yeah. Genetic memory is hard to beat.
We'll leave it there. Sasha, let me talk to you again. Take care, man.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Take care.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you know, the one thing about Sasha there, it was just fascinating to listen to him. But what was palpable was the emotion and the pain. But even within all of that, he was ultimately optimistic.
Look, it's a weird thing. So there's a guy whose entire maternal side of his family were killed in the Holocaust. Yeah. Entire. Right?
That image of leaving Kyiv on horseback is...
Yeah, like, so his mother was the only one of her extended family to get out. So there's a thing in Kyiv at the time, it was called Baba Yar, where 30,000 Jews were killed in 2 days by machine gun, right? Mm. And all his family were part of that. So the pain, the emotion, the strain, the trauma, I think it comes down through... It comes down through... Genetically, he was laughing, it was genetics.
Yeah.
But it's folklore. It's what your parents tell you, what your grandparents tell you. What happened to my people, right? And he is part of that generation of Soviet citizens whose pain was hidden by the overall umbrella of the great glory of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
But every single family has their story. And every single mum and dad has their story. And every single grandparent has their story. But in that world, you weren't allowed to tell the story. Your story became subsumed into the greater Soviet thing. So with Sasha, you know, that's exactly what is that pain you talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
And that trauma. And I think for a lot of Ukrainians is, oh my God, are we going back there again? Are we going back to this? But we should end with the fact that Ukraine is going to become, or is now, the most important country in Europe, if not in the world, geopolitically.
Yeah.
It's energy, it's politics, it's military, it's Cold War, it's everything, right? No other country or no other region. And it's really interesting, in our lifetime, John, Europe shifted to the West. So when we thought of Europe, we thought of France and Denmark and Netherlands and Britain and Ireland. We were European. Europe was a Western Atlantic concept. And that was really new. Now Europe has gone back to where it should be, which is basically Eastern and Central Europe.
Back to where it should be?
Yeah, because like we're not Europeans. We're Atlantic people.
Right.
That's my feel. The map of Europe has changed completely from our time. And the future of Europe is not going to be dictated in Brussels. It's going to be dictated in Kyiv. And that's why we should worry about it, be concerned about it, and invest time in understanding it.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.